You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hello, bodacious and brilliant brain biscuits. Welcome to Good Job Brain, your weekly quiz show and offbeat trivia podcast. This is episode 76, and of course, I'm your humble host, Karen, and we are your darling and sometimes dopey double duo digging for delicious data and details.
Nice.
I'm Colin.
I'm Dana.
And I'm Chris. So I have something. We have the occasionally recurring segment in the headlines, in the news. And I saw a piece of news that reminded me of the good old Good Job Brain podcast.
Yeah, Chris, you like sent a very passionate email to all of us when you read
this.
It
was, yes, if you were a longtime listener, or, you know, just because you know about these sorts of things. Kopi Luwak, which is the coffee, the Indonesian coffee that is tasty and delicious and
the most expensive.
The most expensive coffee anywhere. And it is all these things because, or perhaps in spite of the fact, that it is passed through the entire digestive tract of the civet cat,
right.
a weasel-like animal that eats the coffee fruit and poops the coffee beans.
And that's where it's collected.
Then they collect the poop and they wash the beans are not digested, but they are, the structure of them is changed somehow through the passing through and the bacteria and the gut and the intestines or whatever it is. It is actually made more delicious.
Mm-hmm.
It is a delicious type coffee. And all the civet cat thought it was doing was, you know, eating fruit. And having, like, the worst corn poops, basically. Here's the thing. So now that you've heard it on Good Job Brain and in various other places, demand is increasing for Kopi Luwak. People want to try this.
Yeah.
But the problem is, okay, sure, you're paying hundreds of dollars an ounce for coffee that has been pooped out the butthole of some exotic animal. But how do you know?
Yeah.
How do you know you're not simply being taken for a ride and that someone is not just telling you that these are poop beans?
Or feeding it to a regular cat.
Or a person.
Right.
Yeah.
Or anything.
Yeah.
Well, science and important scientists have now developed a test, and they have identified a certain chemical fingerprint, as the Telegraph said in the UK, chemical fingerprint that only exists in coffee that has been pooped out the butthole of this particular cat.
Oh, of the civet. Okay.
And of the civet.
So it's like test for the coffee.
Indeed. You can now get your verified, tested coffee. Typically, these tests ensure that your food is not contaminated and has not been in contact with poop. But this is a test to make sure that it
is
100% positive.
Yeah. Yes. Poop touched your coffee. We know it for a fact.
Yeah.
Science.
Thanks for that enlightening tidbit.
I'm trying to save you people money.
That's a public service announcement.
Yeah. Verified poop coffee. All right, let's jump into our first general trivia segment, Pop Quiz Hotshot. And I got Trivial Pursuit cards back. So here we go. You guys got your barnyard buzzers ready, and
yes.
I just picked a card randomly from the box. Here we go. Blue wedge for geography. What country is famous for its Gouda and Edam cheeses? Chris.
Is it Switzerland?
Incorrect.
I think it's the Netherlands. Isn't
yes,
it?
Oh, the
oh,
Netherlands.
Yeah.
They're Dutch cheeses.
Dutch cheeses.
Dutch.
Pink wedge for pop culture. Who is Liza Minnelli's mother? Dana.
Judy Garland.
Yes, Judy Garland. Yellow wedge. What are the titles of Barack Obama's first two books? Chris.
Those are Dreams from My Father and The Audacity of Hope.
Correct.
Nice.
Purple wedge. What's the name for the placeholder text used in the printing and publishing industry? Colin.
That is Lorem Ipsum text.
Yes, Lorem Ipsum. Do you know the first five words of Lorem Ipsum placeholder text?
I do. The classic is Lorem Ipsum Dolor Sit Amet.
Yes!
We're surprised.
Yeah,
it's been a long time.
Yeah.
Green wedge for science. This is a good one. What company unveiled the first cell phone in 1983? Chris.
I believe that is Motorola.
Correct.
Yes.
Good bit of trivia to know.
How much did it cost?
Oh.
$1 scabillion.
$3,995.
Okay. Oh, okay. Well, yeah, okay. It's affordable. It's just sure. It's just under 4,000.
Wow.
Wow. And it weighed like 30 pounds. Yeah, right?
It's equivalent to 12 Blueies.
Yeah. You know, for certain businesses, I'm sure that was a huge bargain.
That's true.
To get done what they could then do. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Orange Wedge, last question. What sauce is used in traditional Eggs Benedict? Dana.
Bernays sauce.
Incorrect. Oh. Colin.
Hollandaise.
Oh, no.
So many of you listeners may know that we've been doing this kind of community project, and we're asking listeners to submit pictures or videos of where they are when they're listening to the show. And we got a whole bunch of awesome photos around the world. We're putting it on an interactive map. And there's this one particular email that I got, and it's from the team of Chris, Greg, Anders, Dominic, and Tina. And they wrote in and they said, "Just to let you know that we are regular listeners to your podcast in the kitchen at Peppermaster in Rigaud, province of Quebec, Canada.
Oh.
It helps us pass the time in the excruciating heat of the production kitchen." And, well, what they mean by excruciating heat, not just that it's hot in temperature, but what they do at Peppermaster is they make small batch fair trade hot sauces. Hot and spicy, and heat is their business. And this inspired us for this week to talk about all things that are hot and spicy, makes you sweat, and all that awesome stuff. So thanks to the gang at Peppermaster. This week we're talking about hot stuff.
Looking for some hot stuff, baby. That's
what you have to kick into that song immediately after you say that.
Looking for some hot stuff, baby, this evening. I need some hot stuff, baby, tonight. I want some hot stuff, baby, this evening. Gotta have some hot stuff, gotta have some love tonight.
So do you guys know what is measured by the Scoville scale?
I do.
Yes, I do.
I feel like we may have discussed this. So who would like to enlighten those of us who may not know?
I believe it is called the Scoville heat unit.
Yeah.
Right? The SHU.
Uh-huh. And
right.
What does that measure? What is measured by Scoville heat units?
I think it's how much capsaicin, or the concentration of capsaicin, which is the oil that makes hot pepper spicy.
Yep, that is, the Scoville heat units developed by Wilbur Scoville.
Mr. Scoville.
Mr. Scoville, that's right.
His brother Orville Scoville.
To measure basically the heat of chili peppers. Yeah, indirectly, it's just how hot is a chili pepper, and it's assigned a number on the Scoville scale. But what it is really measuring is, the amount of capsaicin, which is the element that gives chili peppers their heat. And like all chili peppers, all hot peppers have some amount of capsaicin in them that makes them hot. Mm-hmm. And what they'll do is they'll extract it from the pepper. And what the Scoville scale measures is how much do you have to dilute it before you can't taste it, or until you can just barely taste the heat.
With water.
Right. Well, it's actually a mixture of sugar and water. Okay. Yeah, they extract the oil.
Oh, yes.
If you put it in your eyeball, how many days do you take before you can see again?
Yes, the worst test.
Until you go blind. So it goes from zero. So a zero on the Scoville scale for peppers would be like your average bell
like
pepper.
Bell pepper.
Pepper, your average sweet pepper. No capsaicin in those at all. So you eat it, you don't need to dilute it at all. So it's got a zero value of dilution. And then it's an open-ended scale, so it just goes up with there, because it's just the hotter it gets, the more capsaicin, the more you'd have to dilute it. So to give you an idea of sort of what the scale here that we're talking about, so bell pepper's at zero. If you guys know Sriracha sauce, ubiquitous
the rooster
red
sauce.
Rooster sauce. That's right, rooster sauce. That comes in around a couple thousand, maybe so right around 2,000 Scoville on the Scoville scale.
So how much water,
have to dilute it by a factor of 2,000 to get it to a level of the same that you would say this is about the same heat as a bell pepper.
Got it.
Your habaneros are a pretty hot pepper. Mm-hmm. Depending on the variety, those would range a few hundred thousand. Wow. 100,000, maybe up to 600,000, depending on the type of habanero pepper that you're talking about. Just in the last year, experts from the New Mexico State University Chili Pepper Institute. All right. Whoa, this whoa. Yes, these are the world's leading authorities on chili pepper and wait, chili pepper hotness.
Can I like go to school there?
I think you can. Oh. Yes. Yes.
Snap.
Yep. Yeah. You know, it's not too late, Karen.
Oh. I majored in video games. You can do anything.
Yeah. Yeah. New Mexico State. Yeah. Applications are going to be skyrocketing among chili pepper enthusiasts. And there is actually a more modern way of detecting the heat in peppers beyond the Scoville scale. You know, they use things like these days, like liquid chromatography, very highly specialized, computerized, much more consistent. And
with Scoville, you know, you can dilute it, but you still have to have some person there to taste
it. Yeah, that's right. And I didn't really make that part clear, but that's right. So, you know, if you were in the old school Scoville scale, and I mean, you know, this was developed in 1912. It was systematic, but it was a lot of variation. You would dilute it, and then you would have a panel of people all giving their ratings. And you would sort of take the consensus from their ratings to put it on the scale. So they have a lot more high-tech advanced ways of measuring it, but they still will convert those measurements back to a Scoville scale. Because, you know, we've kind of been using the system, but the results we get these days are a lot more scientific. So, as I say, researchers from New Mexico State University Chili Pepper Institute just last year finished a broad survey trying to establish, all right, what is the world's hottest pepper in terms of Scoville units? And it was one I had never heard of before. And I mean, and there were some funky ones on this list. I mean, there's ghost peppers and Naga peppers. And I mean, from every region of the world.
Well, they sound like World of Warcraft characters.
they're supposed to instill fear into you when you hear it.
All the ones that I had heard of, you know, I mean, as I say, habaneros and cayenne. I mean, cayenne pepper is 30,000, 50,000 Scovilles. You know, habanero is a few hundred thousand. They discovered or they established that
the... Hold on.
Yeah, go ahead. Take a guess. I will be amazingly impressed if you know this.
There's like... Well, I know this is one of the hottest, but it's not the hottest. The Scotch bonnet is pretty hot. I think the hottest pepper has like a name place, like the Jamaican something or the Tunisians or the Haitian.
You must have come across this at some point.
Oh, what is it?
The Trinidad Moruga Scorpion pepper.
It's like a D&D character. It's a monster.
It's right there in the name. They had an average, of 1.2 million. Scoville heat units.
Wow.
They had one particular pepper that hit over 2 million.
So if it's 1.2 million, that means if you do a million parts water to one drop of that pepper's juice, you would still go like, oh, it's a little hot.
That would be just noticing it. Essentially.
Wait, it's 1.2 million?
1.2 million on average with the water.
No,
with the
you
water
do
sugar.
1 million and there's still the 0.2 left. It's like a habanero. It's still very
you're right,
hot.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think of like a swimming pool of water and one drop and you drink it and you're like
oh, I got a rash. Just kidding.
But it is. I mean, all the ones that I had heard of sort of are like mid-range on the Scoville heat unit scale of chili peppers. And it's really fascinating to get into. And of course, there are people who are enthusiasts of the hotter the better. They're describing this pepper like you could just take a bite of it and you would not want to do that. You would not want to do that for obvious reasons. They said that when they were harvesting the pepper to do the research, they had to continually change their gloves. It had so much and such strong concentrations of capsaicin.
Yeah.
It was penetrating through the latex gloves and soaking into their skin.
Oh my god. Do they just grow them in Trinidad? Are they just in the mountains?
Yeah, and a lot of these
are... So they're like the poison peppers in the mountains.
Well, I think it's one of those things where, like, if you're an animal unlucky enough to eat it, you're not going to make that mistake twice,
you
know?
Well, what if you're a person or a kid?
Well, people do it on purpose,
Oh, man.
And, you know, like a lot of other peppers, they're cultivated, you know, for spiciness over time, but they are just naturally a hot pepper.
Right.
So, yeah, if you're in Trinidad, you may want to,
the
Moruga Scorpion variety.
Either way.
But, yeah, I mean, and that ties into something else about, you know, if you've ever cut up, you know, made your own hot sauce and cut up peppers, you know that even just a little bit on your finger, you don't realize it. Oh, my God. You rub your eyes, you get it in your mouth, you know.
And that's like normal hot sauce.
Yeah.
Just accidentally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. You know, that's in the thousands of Scoville heat units, and this is upwards of 1 million.
Mm-hmm.
1 million Scoville heat units.
It's not even in your mouth. You can feel it on your skin and your fingers and your eyes and all your pores.
So I don't know if you guys had the same experience, but the first time I ever accidentally been to a hot pepper, I think maybe some Chinese food we had, and you know, it just didn't see it there.
That was me too. I was eating General Tso's chicken.
Yeah.
And they had put the giant red peppers in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
like,
they kind of hide under a piece of chicken or something.
Oh, God!
And I quickly learned, like, drinking water does not help.
You know what really doesn't? Drinking Sprite immediately follows. Also does not help.
Oh, and then you get, like, the carbonation attacking your tongue as well.
When you drink water, you wash away all of the food that's in there, so only the oils remain. You're getting rid of everything but the capsaicin. Yeah.
I mean, and it makes sense. You know, water and oil don't mix.
But it's cooling. I mean, your initial thought is, like, I need a cool...
I was taught that milk was good. And, and milk does kind of soothe it. And then, you know, later I learned that, like, beer, for instance, is also kind of good because the alcohol can cut the oil.
Oh,
so you just need anything to break down the oil of the capsaicin.
A piece of bread.
I got a piece of bread.
Oh, yeah, bread is good, too. But, Karen, our friends at Peppermaster. The Peppermaster, as you mentioned at the top of the show, in addition to letting us know where to listen to the show, also sent in some awesome facts for us. They say that they've discovered the best way to cut that searing pain of the pepper oil on your tongue is a mix of cane sugar, maple syrup, and heavy cream.
So Canadian.
The maple syrup.
Cane sugar, maple syrup, and heavy cream.
And heavy cream. Oh, okay. So it's interesting. The cream I can see. I didn't really know what the sugar is, but according to our friends at the Peppermaster, capsaicin crystals, I guess, are very sharp. It's a sharp crystal. Sugar crystal is a really blunt crystal. Okay, the shape of it on a microscopic level. So mixing in the bluntness of the sugar crystals with the casein of the dairy kind of neutralizes the feeling on the tongue. It neutralizes the sharpness of the crystals and soothes it, and kind of that's the best way to cut the pain. So a mix of something sugary and creamy.
Sounds pretty good.
I heard ice cream.
When you're eating spicy stuff,
you need a milkshake.
Sugar and cream.
Oh, it helps me manage the pain.
Don't worry about it. Why do you got 10 milkshakes?
Why are you drinking hot sauce? Don't worry about that. So, of course, I was thinking about things that are hot, thinking about the word hot, and listening to Will Shortz, the crossword editor of the New York Times, who does the Sunday puzzle on NPR. Mm-hmm. And he does this style of puzzle a lot. I'm like, oh, this works really well with the word hot. So I'm titling this Hot Anagrams here. Get your hot anagrams.
Okay.
So all of these little anagram questions are going to be the word hot, the letters H, O, and T, and then I'm going to add a letter into that mix and ask you what word that means. So, for example, if I were to say hot plus the letter B, the word would be...
Both.
Both.
Sorry.
Both. Typically we buzz and then answer.
I was like, sob.
Sob. So if you listeners are in a convenient place to grab a paper and a pencil, go ahead and do that. If not, it's okay. You can probably figure some of these out. It's just a little bit trickier. Right. But here we go. Here we go.
Oh, Dan's gonna win.
First question.
No.
Hot plus A. Hot plus A. Dana.
Oath.
Oath. It is oath. All right. Hot plus M. Karen.
Moth.
Moth, yes.
My enemy.
Okay. All right. Maybe you're finding these easy. We're going to step it up a little bit to two extra letters.
Mm-hmm.
Hot plus C-L. Dana.
Cloth.
Cloth. Hot plus G-S. Dana.
Ghost.
Ghost. Oh, all right.
Oh, my God.
Hot plus M-U. Dana again.
Mouth.
Mouth. Oh, man, she's rocking it.
I'm Rain Man.
We're taking time to write them down. I have no excuse
then. I'm just staring at the letters.
Hot plus N-R.
Oh.
Colin.
North.
North. Yeah. There's actually a second answer. Hot plus N-R. Anybody want to guess?
Hold on.
Karen?
Thorn.
Thorn, yes. Yep. Hot plus U-Y. Colin.
Youth.
Youth. Mm-hmm. All right. Think you're all so smart. Mm-hmm. Stepping it up to three extra letters.
Okay.
Hot plus A-F-M. Oh. Karen.
Fathom.
Fathom. Yeah. Very good.
Good one.
Hot plus A-R-U. Colin.
Author?
Author, ooh. Yes. Hot plus B-B-I. Colin.
Bivitha. Hobbit?
It is Hobbit.
Nice, okay. Nice.
I was like, wait, is it a proper noun? No, wait, no, it's not.
And finally, hot plus A-M-Z. Here's the tricky one. Hot plus A-M-Z.
A-M-Z.
It's not azimuth.
It's not azimuth.
It's not house.
Is it a...
Oh! Matzah.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Good job, you guys. Killed it.
Woo! All right, guys. It's time to dip into Karen's stash of nightmare animals.
Oh, no.
I haven't shared any nightmare animals for a while. I think the last one was coconut crab.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
A little goes a long way.
Yeah. I think about that sometimes.
I do too. Yeah. It haunts me. But this week, I want to introduce you guys to the bombardier beetle.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay.
Have you heard of that?
I think I've seen these on the Nature Channel before.
Oh, okay. Now, the bombardier beetle is just for like size. It's tiny. It's like half an inch, 1 centimeter long, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of like a big ant. And they're found in most places in the world, probably more common in the southern half of the globe, but not Antarctica. This creature has one of the most unbelievable but awesome defense mechanism in the animal kingdom. And so what happens is when the bug is threatened, the beetle will, number one, make a loud popping sound. And number two, it will fire a noxious boiling hot liquid from its butt.
Where does it get the boiling hot liquid?
And it doesn't stop there. Their butt is like a gun turret. It can rotate and swivel in any direction. And not just straight out from behind. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And has a wide range, so if a predator is coming from the side, or even in front of the bug...
It can shoot things in front of it?
Yes. It, between its legs.
Wow.
It's crazy. And it actually has a really good aim. Like, the accuracy is pretty good. And serving up boiling spray. When I say boiling, it's near boiling. The temperature is near 100 degrees Celsius.
My goodness.
Boiling point of water. And we've come across, you know, lots of animals out there, especially with insects and bugs, that they will secrete some sort of liquid.
Right,
you know,
right.
It's smelly or it's foamy or it's sticky, whatever. But this is almost boiling hot. Okay, so the fluid itself is a mixture of two main things, hydroquinone and hydrogen peroxide.
Okay.
These fluids are naturally occurring for the bug, and the fluids are stored separately in two different chambers in the beetle's body.
It's like a little epoxy tube.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, it is. It's like a reserve. So when the beetle is threatened, the muscles contract and causes both chambers to open.
Oh!
So then there's a third chamber, the mixing chamber, that these two liquids flow in. Now, when these two fluids come together, the reaction is super intense.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a super exothermic reaction.
That's where the heat
that occurs.
Yeah.
And, you know,
like a baking soda volcano kind of thing.
Yeah. So the reaction gives off a buttload of energy,
if you will. E.g.
Quite literally. And what happens is that the liquid, A, because of exothermic, heats up.
Mm.
And then the pressure and gas builds up. And the whole thing just explodes out from the butt valve.
Wow.
Oh.
And emitting a popping sound. And the sound is part of the reaction as well.
Oh, the popping sound is...
It literally explodes out of its butt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it explodes inside its butt. And then
Fraction of a second.
So I think this is where I think I had remember seeing it was on... Someone had done like a super high-speed film study of this beetle. And that was all I knew, is they were studying like how fast it releases. I had no idea that it was boiling hot and noxious. Fluid.
There's videos of it, and you can see how hot it is because you see kind of like steam or gas that comes out as the bug sprays.
Does the bug die?
No, it doesn't. Because what happens is the bug is structured so that the chambers where all these fluids are, they're padded. Or they're lined
insulated
with something.
Yeah.
So their organs are safe from...
It's got a firewall.
I'm so disappointed.
Why?
In the human... But
I know!
We evolved all this stuff, but we don't have multi-directional explosive butts.
How many times on this show have we talked about awesome things that come out from animal butts?
Right.
Wow.
Sounds kind of like a monster.
No, he sounds great. Yeah.
I'm so curious about the multi-directional thing. Is there like a tube or something that's...
They can... It's like they're doing crunches. Like,
oh, I see.
It's core strength.
Oh, great. So they're more fit than we are, too.
I know.
All right, time for a quick break. A word from our sponsor.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Calling all kids in the car. Brittany and Meredith here from the chart-topping Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast. Are you dreading another silent car ride with the fam? We've got the cure. 3 rounds of fresh trivia every single week. Movies, music, even science and Disney. We've got something for every trivia buff in the car. No more crickets chirping on those long journeys. The Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast is your secret weapon for connecting and laughing with kids of all ages. Teens, toddlers, adults, it doesn't matter. Spark their curiosity and challenge their brains with every episode. New episodes drop weekly wherever you get your podcasts. Search for the Family Road Trip Trivia Podcast and turn those car rides into epic adventures.
And we're back. You're listening to Good Job, Ray. And this week we're talking about things that are hot, hot, hot. Oh!
So I'm going to talk about something that also happens in every continent except for Antarctica, and that is firewalking.
Okay.
Every continent?
Yes, there are groups in every continent that practice firewalking, some form of firewalking.
I've never tried it. Have you guys tried it?
No.
I've never tried it. Never tried it.
I understand that if done correctly, it's basically safe.
Yeah.
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 My modifier being, if done correctly.
If done correctly.
Yeah.
If done correctly, everything is safe, though.
Well, sure.
Yeah. But
you're not actually walking on fire. You're walking on, like, things that are heated up, like
coals
or something.
Yeah,
right?
Like hot coals or embers.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yes, you're walking across embers. And by coals or embers, it's not charcoal coals.
Yeah,
usually
coal.
That's too hot. It's wood. Wood doesn't heat up super hot. So basically, I'll give you a little bit of information about how it happens or how you can do it, how it works. So you get hot embers. They're on fire. Probably do wood. It's a little bit safer. It doesn't get as hot as some of the other things. Don't use metal. Metal gets very hot. Don't you? You could, stones are okay too. Certain kinds of stones.
Oh, baby bubble.
I'm sorry. I'm giving you instructions. Like, I think you should do this in your backyard. Don't do it in your backyard. I just tell you how people have done it.
Experts.
People
yes.
who are good at it. Okay. And then you build a runway. There's like a hole. You need to lay it all out and make sure that the embers have been burning for 20 minutes. So that way they're not super hot anymore. There's kind of a layer of ash on them, which is part of the trick. Mm-hmm. Part of how it works. Not the trick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Importantly, like, there is a reason it works with certain materials. Hucksters sell it as mind over matter. Like, oh, this would burn you, but if you believe it won't burn you, you can walk across it and you'll be okay. Like, that is how flimflam people basically sell firewalking to you. No, it's safe. It's actually safe if you do it the right way.
So then you dip your feet in water, because with the physics, you need to, the water adds like a little layer of protection for your feet. It'll burn off. Here's the part where it's mind over matter. Do not run across it. Like, you're freaking out. Your feet are warm. Like, it's getting hot. If you run, you're putting more pressure in there. Your feet go deeper into the embers. You're going to burn the top of your feet.
Yeah. I mean, right. You don't want to freak yourself out.
Yeah.
If I had to do it, I'd be like, I need to get across this the quickest way possible.
No, don't do that. You're going to hurt yourself.
Yeah, you're going to jam your foot.
So you have to be centered. You have to be like, I am walking across this. Walk quickly.
Yeah.
Walk with a purpose, but don't.
but walk gently.
Yes.
My understanding is that essentially the embers are basically like, if you take a cake out of the oven and you touch the pan, you burn yourself. But you can put your fingers on the top of the cake and you're fine, even though it's all the same temperature, because the cake is porous, like the wood.
A lot of
and
air
so,
in it.
But you know,
yeah, but if you put the cake in your mouth and close your mouth and just hold it in there.
Yeah, it would heat up.
It's hot.
Yeah.
It gets really hot.
It is kind of in that in-between area between like real mind over matter and the hucksterism part. You know what I mean? Because as you say, Dana, like, it is, you kind of have to just trust that you're going to be okay and believe in it. But I think you're right, Chris. Like, I've always sort of associated with, you got to just believe in that you're not going to get hurt and focus.
There is no mysticism to it.
Yeah.
The thing with fire walking, though, and is that people aren't convinced with the physics. Like, there is some
controversy.
Some controversy about why it works. Like, is it what physical properties are coming into play with it? And there's this well-renowned quote unquote. I mean, I was looking at firewalking.com, and he's a Harvard-trained physician and medical researcher, and he said that the literature on firewalking is dreadful, and there's no way that he's convinced that mental state is not the key variable in firewalking. And I'm like, I don't know what to believe about that. But
yeah, well, I mean, the water, like you say, the water on your feet, you get a little, it burns that off before it burns your skin. The ash kind of insulates. The wood is cool-ish compared to other things being hot. I may have seen this on MythBusters or one of those type of shows, but they're saying, I think like one of the reasons they tend to do this at night as well is so that just the ambient temperature is a lot lower as well. The air is cooler.
Yeah,
again, it's not really a trick, but it's just you want to do everything that you can to make it less likely that you burn yourself, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could do it in Antarctica. Yeah.
Like, it's just too cold. It's too cold.
You probably could. It's just there's nobody really lives there.
That's kind of what I was thinking.
Like, there's a bunch of researchers.
Yeah.
Well, it is actually a pretty warm day here. I think it's very...
Not even warm. It's hot.
It is hot. Well, it is a hot day.
Too darn hot.
I think it is appropriate. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't get crazy
by
hot.
By which we mean, like, what, in the 80s?
Yeah. I was just going to say. I mean, people in Texas, you know, they don't want to hear...
Vegas
We're
right
in Berkeley. It's a balmy high 70s, maybe 80. And I think it's fair to say air conditioning is one of those modern conveniences that we sometimes take for granted. Oh, yeah.
I love the sound of it. It's so soothing. Just growing.
The smell of conditioned air.
That there is that glorious moment when you're out in the streets of, you know, Phoenix or Houston or Las Vegas, wherever you are, and you come into a store and just that icy blast hits you.
Like diving into a swimming pool.
Yeah.
Oh. And I had touched on air conditioning before in a long ago episode of Good Job Brain.
It was on our Inventions episode.
That's right. Yeah. And we were talking about how, you know, one of the more modern systems of air conditioning was developed in the aftermath of President James Garfield being shot in 1881. They needed to find a way to cool his room off where they were trying to help him recuperate.
And that was just like a series of tubes and ice.
It was, I mean, and, you know, there have been a lot of sort of historical systems like this where you use some salt, you know, to an ice to bring the temperature of water below freezing, and you run air past it and it cools the air. And, you know, there are examples of the Egyptians doing this and the Chinese having various versions of this. But what makes those kind of systems different from when we talk about modern air conditioning is, do you guys, like, what is the primary feature of modern air conditioning compared to things like laying wet towels in the window and just letting the air come in and cool, which does in fact cool the air?
Well, there's a fan.
There is a fan. They've had earlier systems with fans.
It's not wet.
It's dehumidified. You're right. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
When we talk about modern air conditioning, it's not just cooling the air, but it's pulling the moisture out of the air as well, so it can stay cooler and is a much more efficient way of cooling.
Huh.
First modern air conditioner was invented by Willis Carrier. Carrier Air Conditioning Company is still in business today. He was the one who really came up with the first modern system. And he was an engineer. He was working for a heavy equipment manufacturer in New York State. And he was working on a problem for a printing company that they worked with. As he looked into it, they realized it kind of came down to the humidity. The humidity was affecting not only the paper, it was affecting the way the inks would dry, the way the inks would take to the paper. You know, there had been large-scale air control systems and ventilation systems before, but there hadn't been one that was specifically designed to control the humidity. So this was what Willis Carrier came up with. He came up with the first modern system that would cool the air and pull the humidity out and solve the printing company's problem. They could keep it at a nice, consistent, predictable, drier air.
But really, it's the dehumidifying part that was the
draw. That's right. That's what made it different from anything that came before. It was pulling the moisture out.
Yeah, those people who worked at that press, this is pretty nice.
I like this. This is great. But he kind of reasoned backward from steam heating. He's like, well, you know, we know that you can use steam, hot steam, to really heat up a room pretty well and make it nice and toasty. Part of the reason that you can do that and it holds the heat so well, it's got a lot of water in the air. So he's like, well, let me go backward. If I can take the humidity out of the air, I can cool it a lot more efficiently. He would run air through through cold coils. You know, he would chill the coils. And as you know how condensation works, the water would condense on the coils, and then the air, now dried, moves in and cools off the room.
Where does the water go?
They have, you know, you collect it in a pan. You know, I mean, for example, if you ever see an air conditioner on a hot day dripping water on the outside, that's condensed water that's being pulled out of the air that it's conditioning. This was an expensive proposition at first, and it's not going to surprise you that for a long time, air conditioning was kind of the province of big factories or hospitals things that could afford to set up just the massive ducts that you would need and the electricity to run the thing all day. But it was clear that, like, wow, this can really transform business. He didn't call it an air conditioner at first. He called it just an apparatus for treating air. you know, he was industrial. He was industrial.
After.
Yeah, it was. They did come up with the name air conditioning a few years later, but at that time, it just sort of meant any treatment of air. In fact, the first air conditioner with that name applied to it was actually a humidifier. Mm. So it was actually putting humidity into the air. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, it was not too long before it got to be that if you said air conditioning, you meant cooled air conditioning. So it grew steadily, mostly industrial. Willis Carrier had an air-conditioned igloo at the 1939 World's Fair to kind of demonstrate and show off this technology for home use. I mean, this was really their hope, was that they could get into home use. And the first units were expensive and big and loud. As late as like the 1940s, Carrier Company was selling the atmospheric cabinet that would go into your home, and it was roughly the size of an upright piano.
Okay. Wow!
Yeah. So it was a slowly adopted technology until 1951, when they invented the window unit, the now seemingly ubiquitous window air conditioning unit. So it was tiny. The noisy part was on the outside. You didn't have to hear it as much.
Yeah.
In 1952, they went from basically no sales of window air conditioning units to $250 million in sales.
Yeah.
That's 1952 dollars, by the way. So the window air conditioning unit, just, it transformed life. I mean, you know, a lot of researchers and historians, they really credit the development of the window air conditioning unit to booming populations in the Southwest. You know, that it was really after this, there was a convenient, relatively affordable way of cooling a house to normal temperature, that the population booms in, you know, what they call the Sun Belt, and particularly the Southwest, really took off.
That makes sense.
Air conditioning in cars quickly took off. You know, it just became kind of a must-have. You know, again, if you lived in the West or the Southwest, you know, driving on a hot day, you'd much rather have the AC go.
When I was a kid, that was not, like, standard on cars yet. You know, it was a big deal when we got our first car with an air conditioner.
Yeah, I'm talking about taking it for granted. I was doing some research again, thinking about, all right, where do I most appreciate the air conditioning? And
Train.
It was on the train. It was on the subway.
Oh, sure.
The New York subway, they started trials of air conditioning in the 50s and 60s. You know, they had a few kind of spot tests machines, and they worked pretty well. Like, they brought the temperature down to bearable. The temperature and the humidity to bearable levels. Yeah. By the mid-1980s, only half of the trains in the New York subway had air conditioning.
Oh. Yeah.
And there are, you know, and it wasn't until 1993 that as high as 99% of the cars in the system were covered.
Wow.
Jeez Louise.
I always took that for granted. And I can't even imagine riding a car in, say, you know, 1989, and there's a chance that you may not have air conditioning.
Right.
Ew.
You're right, yeah.
So we have Mr. Willis Carrier to thank for our modern, luxurious, conditioned, cool air.
Good thinking on his part.
Thanks, buddy.
Hey, Matt. Did you know that wombats poop cubes?
Nope. Never heard that before.
Did you know the unicorn is the national animal of Scotland, Ken?
I didn't know, nor do I care.
Neil, did you know that Liechtenstein is the only doubly landlocked country in Europe?
Jeff, isn't that an American pop artist?
Well, actually, it's both. If you want to learn things like that and more, join us each week on Triviality, a pub trivia-style game show podcast where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Listen in each week to answer general knowledge trivia alongside exciting guests from around the world.
And we're here, too.
Join us every Tuesday for new hour-long episodes of Triviality, plus tons of extra theme content on everything from The Office and Lord of the Rings to science and geography.
And sometimes we even do sports.
Find us on all your preferred podcast apps and take part in the fun of playing bar trivia without the need to wear pants.
Real mature, Jeff.
Forget it, Neil. It's Triviality.
All right, and we have one more hot segment. And Chris, you got a quiz for us?
I do.
Ooh.
This is a quiz all structured around temperatures, the measuring of heat.
Hmm. Thank you
Not
for
spiciness.
Clarifying.
Yes, as opposed to Scoville's. Yes. So let me ask you this question. What is 0 degrees on the Kelvin scale more commonly known as?
That's...
Yeah. Colin.
Is that absolute zero?
That is absolute zero. Yes, it is roughly negative 460 degrees Fahrenheit. Mm. It is the coldest something can get, theoretically. True or false? According to the International Bureau of Weights and Measures, the Celsius scale is defined by the freezing point of water being 0 Celsius and the boiling point of water being set at 100 Celsius.
Oh, that was
Dana.
True.
False. Right, false. It was a trick question. In the past, the Celsius scale was defined by that, but now, according to the IB of WM, the way that they do both the Celsius and the Kelvin scales is it is defined by the triple point of water, which is the point at which, at a certain temperature and a certain pressure, water is considered to be all three stages of water are within equilibrium. They are just on the line where minor changes in pressure and temperature would cause it to go from liquid to solid, solid to gas. You know, that is marked at 273.16 degrees Kelvin or 0.01 degrees Celsius.
Okay.
So basically they have a standard for like super, super pure water, and then they measure the triple point of that and they mark that as 273.16 degrees Kelvin. And then everything flows from that.
Got it. All relative to that.
And yes, that does actually mean that to convert between Celsius and Kelvin, you just add or subtract 273.15. At about negative 108 degrees Fahrenheit, dry ice turns from a solid to a gas, skipping the liquid state. What is this process called? Oh. Colin?
Isn't that called sublimation?
It is called sublimation.
What?
Yeah.
What do you call it? Sublimation?
Sublimation. Like sublime.
Oh, yeah. The band.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Sublimation.
What is dry ice? Karen!
Oh. No.
It is frozen carbon. Dioxide.
Yes.
It was
frozen carbon dioxide, solid carbon dioxide. Yeah. Yes. Okay.
When I was a kid,
I
played around with it. Yeah.
No.
That I was always told you it'll burn you if you touch it.
I like inhale. I don't know. I just because sometimes they pack it in with ice cream and stuff to transport. And
I would always say that homemade haunted houses and things like that.
Oh, of course.
You know, put it in the bucket with the water.
Well, it sublimates right in front of you. Because it doesn't pass through the liquid phase, so it turns from the solid to smoke, vapor, essentially. Yeah, but don't touch it. It's really cold.
Yeah, no, don't do that.
No.
Don't do what Karen did.
At around 300 degrees Fahrenheit, the Maillard reaction happens. That's M-A-I-L-L-A-R-D, the Maillard reaction. What is the Maillard reaction? Karen?
It is when you bake, and that is when the sugar or... No, hold on! This is toast. This is something to do with baking and toast. This is when the toast becomes crunchy and brown.
Yes, it is the browning of food.
So it took me a while to get.
So when you bake bread and the outside becomes brown, it is different from caramelization. It's a different chemical process, but it's also when you sear a steak and the steak becomes brown, or when you toast bread and it becomes brown. That is the Maillard reaction.
Ooh.
Yes. 300 degrees Fahrenheit, approximately. The temperature at which paper burns is 451 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yes.
Oh, that's where the book title comes from?
Yes, that is the temperature at which paper burns.
Is
that?
My mind.
That's 451 degrees Fahrenheit.
It's a science reference.
So is that temperature closer to 100, 200, or 300 degrees Celsius? Multiple choice. 100, 200, or 300? Karen.
200.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Because boiling in Fahrenheit is 212, I think, or is 200 something.
Yeah.
And
that's 100.
Lots of ways to get there. 232 degrees Celsius is the equivalent. You subtract 32 and divide by 1.8.
Holy.
That's one I can never ever remember that conversion. Mm-hmm. Every time I need to Google it.
Nine
every
over time. Five.
Nine over five. Yeah.
Yeah.
Finally, according to Wikipedia, what is hotter? I'm going to give you three things. You tell me what the hottest of the three things is. The core of the sun, the maximum peak temperature of a hydrogen bomb, or the core of a star about to go type 2 supernova. What is the hottest?
I'm going to guess the last one, the core of the star
star about to go supernova. Well, the sun's core is 16 million degrees Celsius.
Oh, balmy.
a hydrogen bomb can actually peak out at 350 million degrees Celsius.
Wow.
Yes, that is much hotter than the core of the sun.
Wow.
But a high-mass star right before it pops off is 3 billion degrees Celsius. It is hot.
That's one of those numbers. It's I can't even fathom what that scale of hot is.
You use blue whales.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. How many
like,
blue whales
is that? What happens in that reaction is that you have metals in there, in the star, that start turning into heavier metals because, like, the nuclear fusion is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And finally it explodes. And you don't want to be there when it does.
I know. Yeah. So Karen's like, when I was little,
I just buy it. This looks so beautiful.
I like that voice.
I like young Karen voice.
Awesome. Well, that's our hot show. Thank you guys for joining me. And thank you guys, listeners, for listening in. Hope you learned a lot about firewalking, about the crazy butt beetle, bombardier beetle, air conditioning, hot word quiz, and other stuff. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and also on our website, goodjobbrain.com. And don't forget to check out our sponsor, Audible, at audiblepodcast.com/goodjobbrain. And a very big special thank you to the gang at The Pepper Master for sending us photos of your kitchen, but also giving us some trivia and the inspiration for today's show. And if you have a crazy hobby or a job, feel free to send us cool trivia tidbits. We'd love to share them on the show. And I guess we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.